And these beings, one may assume, not dogmatizing, but I think, are ever available to all, and particularly for the special purpose of helping those in deep need, unendurable need, you know. I suppose, I'm detaching a moment myself now, I suppose that ideally one should not pray for benefits for oneself and on the whole try to stand up to the difficulties and learn from them and come through them if possible. But things can get so bad that they're beyond one's power. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to turn to some very great being. I think it's permissible and even advisable to turn to a known spiritual source, a divine friend in one's friendlessness, for comfort and counsel and for aid. I think so. I think these forces are very real. When one first goes to India and visits the temples and sees in all of them hundreds of people day by day passing through the temples, stopping at all the multitude of images, making certain gestures, perhaps chanting some of our chants that we chant, and praying earnestly. Some so poor, so thin, some with little babies, they're hardly alive in their arms, you know. Whilst at first the philosopher in one might say, oh, what a lot of superstition, you know. What a pity, so ignorant and superstitious. But I think I've grown out of that idea myself now. And I'm glad there is somewhere they can go and some being to whom they can turn. And so in our own religion, and so everywhere. So my answer to your question, therefore, is yes, I believe in prayers of intercession. May I tell you a story about this? Story about St. Peter, who you know is supposed to keep the gates of heaven. According to this conception, I suppose, heaven is a walled city. And the great golden gate, pearly and golden gates, aren't there? And there it's the task of St. Peter to see that no wrong ones get in. And only the just and worthy are allowed to go to heaven. And St. Peter one day, if they have days in heaven, was performing his duties to the best of his ability. So the story goes. He happened to look along the wall. And he saw a woman there, on a balcony overlooking the depths below. And she was undoing her knotted belt, whatever it was, which held her blue dress together. And she was letting it down into the world below. And all sorts of ragged and dirty looking people were being pulled up into heaven. St. Peter was indignant. So he went out and found the master. Ask his master Jesus. He said, do you see that woman over there? Here am I trying my best to keep the gates and see that only decent people are let in here, and just look who she's looking at letting in. So he said, do you know who that woman is, Master? He said, yes, it's my mother. So the beneficent ones exist. Next question. In your exposition of the path of discipleship and initiation, you referred to a close attunement between disciple and master, which is established when a certain high stage is passed through. Does this mean that the master knows all the time exactly what the disciple is doing? I hardly think so. I verbally answered no. Partly because the masters are very busy people. Very busy. We don't know what being busy is compared to them. Because they're active at so many levels at the same time. They are responsible for the function of the divine will, wisdom and intelligence on this earth. They're vehicles for it, and they have their various responsibilities in that connection. Then they have the whole of life in each kingdom within their consciousness, all mankind especially. And so it would seem quite impossible for a master to know, watch a particular disciple all day long and all day. So I answer definitely no to this, within the great limitations of my knowledge. Doesn't seem reasonable to me. Furthermore, their relationship is much more with the ego, so I understand, than with the personal nature. Though the latter is not neglected, of course, one assumes, because this personality has to be gradually improved and disciplined, purified, and the master helps and guides in that. But much more so, I understand, through the ego itself. But I understand from various sources that the master of a person who really is a disciple can know at any moment, by instant observation or attention, what a pupil is doing. Yes, he can know at any moment. But I don't think that the daily actions of a disciple would concern him very much. He would be more interested when some important work were being done, or when there were marked expressions of the personality, when some test is being gone through to see how the disciple is managing. All of these, yes, on occasions, but one would hope certainly not all the time. Of course, when I answer questions, whether verbal or written, about masters, I am only referring to to those adepts of whom we gain knowledge through chiefly philosophical literature and work, and other sources which derive from philosophical literature. There doubtless are a great many other adepts on the planet of whom we know little or nothing. So I think I ought to be truthful and helpful to say no, not all the time. May I add this? It is very, very important to be quite sure that one really is in this relationship. And as far as I understand, the master arranges that a senior disciple shall physically inform the newly accepted disciple who has succeeded through probation. I understand so. Or there may, I presume, be such a transcendent spiritual experience as to make one feel sure, but I think one should be very, very careful indeed about such claims, such thoughts, that one is necessarily at that level. Modesty and humility and realism become us in our relationships with the masters and our attempts to reach the higher levels of human evolution. As far as I learn, the two great difficulties which confront aspirants are personal self-gratification and pride and a tendency to build up a structure of self-delusion. Against these two, which are the great, great dangers besetting the would-be occultist, in addition to the others, against these two, may I presume to suggest that we should continually be on guard. Is our structure of consciousness, is the building of thought to which we have given ourselves, is it really so? You say, how do we know? Well, I'm personally satisfied with the structure of theosophical teaching, ancient and modern. The synthesis of the esoteric wisdom of the philosophies and religions of the ages. That's enough for me. And I feel that whilst we mustn't restrict each other or ourselves in the slightest degree, there is a safe line to follow. I'm speaking in answer to this question a little fully because of experiences in America. If an American present will allow me to say so, and as they know, there are a great number of movements in America which deal with this question and offer all kinds of opportunities along these lines. And there are a great number of people, and I met many of them, who have the greatest and most exalted ideas of their spiritual and occult attainments. I confessed to a certain hesitation about much of it. And that's decided me in my experiences, often through, just to give this warning, especially when I'm in a group of very earnest and sincere students. What else of that you ask? Would you kindly repeat your interpretation of the passion and crucifixion of Christ? very big subject, friends. I just begin. I don't know where to begin. It began in Gethsemane, didn't it? With the betrayal. That pathetic experience in the darkness. When one of the chosen disciples, Judas himself, betrayed his Lord for 30 pieces of silver. And he led the enemies, which is fought with torches, up to where Jesus was and said to them, "Him whom I kiss, that is he." And then Jesus was there with the disciples and Judas walked up to him. And in one of the Gospels, I think, Jesus said to him, "What you are about to do, do it quickly." I've always thought that to be such a tragic situation. Well, may we presume that Judas is a personification of bodily cupidity and treachery. All three personal bodies being guilty. The 30 pieces of silver, by theosophical reduction, as the numerologists say, becomes three, and is interpreted then mind, emotions, and body. We're all involved. The possessive, separative, and plotting qualities of the lower mind can destroy or betray spiritual vision, the Christ. And they are personified by Judas. So Judas personifies matter and the material, possessive, selfish tendencies. So I suggest. Peter, you know, the other disciple, he tried to dissuade the Christ, you know, from accepting his passion. When the Lord foretold it to the disciples, Peter couldn't stand it. He said, "Oh Lord, you must not do this. We can't bear this." Not seeing that it was really the outworking of a great, almost cosmic plan. And it was very interesting there because Jesus said, "Get thee behind me, Satan. What I must do, I must." Well, Peter, I think, represents the mind and the emotions which attempt to dissuade and to deny the onward progress through difficulties because of fear. Satan personifies the mind as tempter, chiefly through pride. For a time they succeed, but at last the soul, the Christ within, defeats them, rises above them, sublimates. So Judas in Gethsemane, it might seem, represents the triple personality, mind, emotions, body, making a last bid for separated existence. But the intuition of the awakened person, personified by the Christ, foresees this already. So when Jesus, who could easily have saved himself, remember, surrendered and said, as I've just quoted, "What you are about to do, do it quickly." John 12:27. You know, Pilate, in a very interesting study, by the by, all of these are little cameos within the larger story. Well worth studying. Peter, who thus tried to prevent the Lord and later denied him thrice, but recovered. We look at that a good time, either now or next week. Pilate, I suggest, is the formal worldly mind, in the process of becoming illumined, but not yet so. And his wife represents the intuition. She wasn't there. But she sent him a messenger. She wasn't there. He wasn't illumined. Had to be a messenger. She says what? I've had a dream by day. Now, day in the sacred language always means a state of illumination. She sent a message, the messenger. Pilate was not directly illumined, not in an intuitive state. But his wife's message reaches him from a distance through a messenger. But he wasn't strong enough. She said, have nothing to do with this good man. That was the message. That was her dream. Pilate couldn't. He couldn't respond. He fell under the blackmailing of the crowd, which said, this man claims that he's the king of the Jews. If you don't condemn him, we'll tell Herod. You'll be displaced and lose your power, perhaps punished. So the mind's desire for office, its readiness to betray ideals for self-gratification, these are portrayed, and he fails for that life. He pandered to the crowd instead of standing for justice impersonally. Probably too great a threat. Who could have done? Remember the first of the four keys I gave you? All happens within. This is our story. It's also magically told that although it's presumed to be an account of historical events, it also is a marvelously accurate description of the soul of man in various stages of evolution, including approaching initiation. And if you read the story, you'll notice that eventually Pilate seems to have recovered. You know, he was writing, as I said the other day, I believe, the inscription to go over the cross, on the cross. And he wrote, the King of the Jews. And a man went by and said, why don't you write, he said that I'm the King of the Jews. And Pilate refused to alter it. He said, what I've written, I've written. And he left it so. The mind, when fully, at last, fully illumined, stands firm for principle, though at first he seems to have failed. He did, of course, you know, after the interrogation, he turned to the people, he said, I find no fault in this man. But he will not deny Jesus to the crowd. And so Jesus came forth wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe of a king in mockery and the reed as a scepter. Mockery. Pilate said to them, behold the man. And they cried, crucify him, crucify him. John 19. Verses 4 and 6. The lower attributes cry out against the disciplining of the higher self. Try to resist it and won't yield to it at first. But eventually they have to. Then there's that very interesting, yes, very interesting act of Pilate. Do you remember it? What did he do when it was all over? Washed his hands. So Pilate washed his hands, and the world has never forgiven him for that. The mind that refuses to respond to illumination and denies conscience, his wife's message, must close itself against the experience, must, like Pharaoh, harden his heart. Otherwise there's no peace. The soul that in pride deliberately chooses the wrong path must cut itself off from the higher self or endure the unbearable torture of humiliation. Outraged conscience. So it says, he washed his hands. Well, Peter, you remember, he denied his Lord three times, three levels. Where was he at the time? He wasn't there. He wasn't with the Lord. He wasn't illumined by the divine presence at the time. He was not in the courtroom. He was in the guardroom. And a woman came by and said, "Hello, that's one of his followers." And Peter fell. He fell. Mentally, emotionally, and physically. Three times he denied him. In the dark, and it was dark. Remember, it was dark. The story is marvelously told from the symbolical point of view, because just as day means its inner illumination, so night means spiritual darkness. And he was in spiritual darkness. And he wasn't in the presence of the Lord. So at the three levels, he denied the truth. Then what happened? Very pathetic, very beautiful, really. Dawn came, and the cock crowed three times. Mantra, mantric power, the consciousness. And he wept bitterly. But being more highly developed than Pilate, at daybreak, which means a return of spiritual consciousness, he then repented and wept bitterly. Luke 13, verse 62. The cock crowed thrice, signaling the return of light to the personal nature. He recovered and became one of the greatest disciples. Then Christ bears the cross. And I've told you about flagellation. And the skin being the symbol of self-separateness, which is destroyed. As a deathship is approached, so the flagellation and the prick of the crown of thorns and later the nails and the spear all prick the skin, the part which separates the individual from all else, you see. That must be pierced. And you read the stories of the death of the gods, of all religions and mythologies, you'll find the great heroes and their skin is pierced. Sri Krishna by an arrow. Achilles, by a wound in the heel. Balder the beautiful, by a stroke in the back. Because when he was dipped in the water of invulnerability, a leaf fell and settled on his back so that the water didn't reach him. There, he was killed by his enemy, pride. He was also invulnerable, was Balder the Beautiful in the Nordic mysteries, being given immortality and invulnerability against all weapons made from trees. How was he killed? By a weapon made from mistletoe. That's how he was killed. It's not a tree, you see, it's a parasite. And so on. These are all ways in which I suggest to you, by allegory and symbol, there is an appeal by the teacher to the conscience, to the intuition, to see underneath the wonderful stories, beautiful in themselves, an underlying deep truth. And so the initiate must accept and meet his just debts to nature. And so Christ voluntarily bears the cross. He's disrobed. Before that, nakedness. Another symbol in the sacred language. A personality naked to spiritual truth. A complete self-revealing. The meaning of nakedness. Only then can spiritual blindness be overcome. You remember the story of blind Bartimaeus at the gate? He heard some steps coming. He heard someone say, it's Jesus of Nazareth, the great healer in our land. What did he do? He threw away his garment. Then said to the Christ, heal me, give me back my sight. And the Lord healed him and gave him his sight again. He got rid of that which was keeping the light from him. Symbolically, his garment of self-separateness and so on. So nakedness is said to be very, very important as a symbol. The nakedness at the nativity of Christ portrays the innocence, possessionlessness, purity, and the soul's faithful exposure to the Spirit, come what may. Freedom from pretense, freedom from the corruptions of the world. All this is portrayed by the nakedness of the Christ at birth and at his disrobing. Utmost purity, freedom from all limitations of the lower world and lower nature. Truth freely manifest, revealed from within. And at initiation, everything extraneous is stripped away, and only the pure spirit remains, and is wholly discovered, revealed. Then and then only can the full illumination occur. And then they parted his garments, do you remember? They parted my garments among them, and upon my vestures did they cast lots. There, I have time to go on with this. I'll take this up with you, if you like, next Friday. Will we be together next Friday? I'll just touch on this. It's the seamless dress, do you remember? Jesus wore a seamless dress. Symbol of the boundless space, containing, filling all space and all atoms, the ether of space. But when the Lord of all becomes manifested in nature, in the innumerable forms, he submits to the parting of that garment, and his life goes into all sorts of separate forms. So they part his garments cosmically amongst them. I'd like, before I close, just to say one thing to you. If you can go with me and stay a few minutes longer. Christ is crucified between two thieves. Two people of the same kind. Why? I'm not contesting historicity now. We're in another level of study. Something eternal, rather than historical. Well, whenever you get two of a kind in the sacred language of symbols and allegories, it generally means the higher and lower minds. It's the same thing, the intellect at work, on the one hand as the analytical, ratiocinating, individualistic, logical, valuable mind on the one hand, and on the other, the abstract intelligence which perceives principles and underlying laws and processes. Now, before the great illumination can be achieved, these two attributes of the mind have to be thoroughly understood and kept apart for use each in its proper time. And so Christ is crucified between two thieves, one on either hand, it says. Carefully, carefully. This is supported by the remarks of the two. One scoffed and scorned, saying, you saved others, why don't you save yourself? Now's your time. Scoffed at the Lord. The other one said, Lord, promise me that I may be with you this day in paradise. See the difference? Two attributes of the mind. And it's said to be only then that within the brain mind the great illumination of the Christ consciousness can fully occur. And remember, it's all within the brain mind. Don't forget that. It's an interior, the crucifixion is an interior experience. It occurs within you, see? And you pass through it within you. It's a terrible agony, I imagine. And when it's going on, and when it's achieved, the whole of the brain, consciousness, is illumined by the light of the intuition. The Christ stands forth, as it were, between the two aspects of the active intellect. The person's fully illumined, wide awake, in the brain. Any support for that in the story? Where is the brain? In the same place as the crucifixion is said to have taken place. On Golgotha, the place of the skull. Nothing could be plainer. It all takes place on the place of the skull. There I leave it. Think it over and continue next Friday.